At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Part 1, Chapter 10 of Burning Daylight by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Still men were without faith in the strike. When Daylight, with his heavy outfit of flour, arrived at the mouth of the Klondike, he found the big flat as desolate and tenantless as ever. Down close by the river, Chief Isaac and his Indians were camped beside the frames on which they were drying salmon. Several old-timers were also in camp there. Having finished their summer work on 10 Mile Creek, they had come down the Yukon, bound for Circle City. But at 60 Mile, they had learned of the strike and stopped off to look over the ground. They had just returned to their boat when Daylight landed his flour, and their report was pessimistic. "Damn moose pasture," quoth one, Long Jim Harney, pausing to blow into his tin mug of tea. "Don't you have nothing to do with it, Daylight. It's a blamed rotten cell. They're just going through the motions of a strike, Harper and Ledoux's behind it, and Carmack's the stool pigeon. Who ever heard of mining a moose pasture half a mile between Rimrock and God alone knows how far to bedrock?" Daylight nodded sympathetically and considered for a space. "Did y'all pan any?" he asked finally. "Pan hell," was the indignant answer. "Think I was born yesterday? Only a chechaku fool around with that pasture long enough to fill a pan of dirt. You don't catch me at any such foolishness. One look was enough for me. We're pulling on in the morning for Circle City. I ain't never had faith in this upper country. Head reaches of the Tanana is good enough for me from now on. And mark my words, when the big strike comes, she'll come down river. Johnny here staked a couple of miles below Discovery, but he don't know no better." Johnny looked shamefaced. "I just did it for fun," he explained. "I'd give my chance in the creek for a pound of Star Plug." "I'll go you," Daylight said promptly. "But don't you all come squealing if I take 20 or 30,000 out of it." Johnny grinned cheerfully. "Give me the tobacco," he said. "Wish I'd staked alongside," Long Jim murmured plaintively. "It ain't too late," Daylight replied. "But it's a 20-mile walk there and back." "I'll stake it for you tomorrow when I go up," Daylight offered. "Then you'd do the same as Johnny? Get the fees from Tim Logan. He's tending bar in the Sourdough, and he'll lend it to me. Then fill in your own name, transfer it to me, and turn the papers over to Tim." "Me too," chimed in the third old-timer. And for 3 pounds of Star Plug chewing tobacco, Daylight bought outright 3 500-foot claims on Bonanza. He could still stake another claim in his own name, the others being merely transfers. "Must say you're almighty brash with your chewing tobacco," Long Jim grinned. "Got a factory somewheres?" "Nope, but I got a hunch," was the retort. "And I'll tell y'all, it's cheaper than dirt to ride her at the rate of 3 plugs for 3 claims. But an hour later, at his own camp, Joe Ledoux strolled in, fresh from Bonanza Creek. At first noncommittal over Carmack's strike, then later dubious, he finally offered Daylight $100 for his share in the town site. "Cash?" Daylight queried. "Sure, there she is." So saying, Ledoux pulled out his gold sack. Daylight hefted it absent-mindedly, and still absent-mindedly untied the strings and ran some of the gold dust out on his palm. It showed darker than any dust he had ever seen, with the exception of Carmack's. He ran the gold back, tied the mouth of the sack, and returned it to Ledoux. I guess you all need it more than I do, was Daylight's comment.
Nope, got plenty more, the other assured him.
Where'd that come from?
Daylight was all innocence as he asked the question, and Ladue received the question as stolidly as an Indian. Yet for a swift instant, they looked into each other's eyes, and in that instant, an intangible something seemed to flash out from all the body and spirit of Joe Ladue. And it seemed to Daylight that he had caught this flash, sensed the secret something in the knowledge and plans behind the other's eyes.
"You all know the creek better than me," Daylight went on, "and if my share in the town site's worth 100 to you all with what you know, it's worth 100 to me, whether I know it or not."
"I'll give you 300," Ladue offered desperately.
"Still the same reasoning. No matter what I don't know, it's worth to me whatever y'all willing to pay for it."
Then it was that Joe Ladue shamelessly gave over. He led Daylight away from the camp and the men and told him things in confidence.
"She's sure there," he said in conclusion. "I didn't sluice it or cradle it. I panned it, all in that sack, yesterday on the rim rock. I tell you, you can shake it out of the grass roots. And what's on bedrock down in the bottom of the creek, there ain't no way of telling. But she's big, I'll tell you, big. Keep it quiet and locate all you can. It's in spots, but I wouldn't be none surprised if some of them claims yielded as high as 50,000. The only trouble is that it's spotted."
A month passed by, and Bonanza Creek remained quiet. A sprinkling of men had staked, but most of them, after staking, had gone on down the 40-mile and Circle City. The few that possessed sufficient faith to remain were busy building log cabins against the coming of winter. Carmack and his Indian relatives were occupied in building a sluice box and getting a head of water. The work was slow, for they had to saw their lumber by hand from the standing forest. But farther down Bonanza were four men who had drifted in from upriver: Dan McGilvary, Dave McKay, Dave Edwards, and Harry Wall. They were a quiet party, neither asking nor giving confidences, and they herded by themselves. But Daylight, who had panned the spotted rim of Carmack's claim and shaken coarse gold from the grass roots, and who had panned the rim at 100 other places up and down the length of the creek and found nothing, was curious to know what lay on bedrock. He had noted the four quiet men sinking a shaft close by the stream, and he had heard their whipsaw going as they made lumber for the sluice boxes. He did not wait for an invitation, but he was present the first day they sluiced. At the end of 5 hours shoveling for one man, he saw them take out 13 ounces and a half of gold. It was coarse gold, running from pinheads to a $12 nugget, and it had come off bedrock. The first fall snow was flying that day, and the Arctic winter was closing down. But Daylight had no eyes for the bleak gray sadness of the dying, short-lived summer. He saw his vision coming true, and on the big flat was upreared anew his golden city of the snows. Gold had been found on bedrock. That was the big thing. Carmack's strike was assured. Daylight staked the claim in his own name, adjoining the three he had purchased with his plug tobacco. This gave him a block of property 2,000 feet long and extending in width from rimrock to rimrock. Returning that night to his camp at the mouth of the Klondike, he found in it Kama, the Indian he had left at D.A. Kama was traveling by canoe, bringing in the last mail of the year. In his possession was some $200 in gold dust, which Daylight immediately borrowed. In return, he arranged to stake a claim for him, which he was to record when he passed through 40 Mile. When Kama departed next morning, he carried a number of letters for Daylight, addressed to all the old-timers downriver, in which they were urged to come up immediately and stake. Also, Kama carried letters of similar import,
given him by the other men on Bonanza.
"It will sure be the gosh dangdest stampede that ever was," Daylight chuckled, as he tried to vision the excited population of 40 Mile and Circle City tumbling into poling boats and racing the hundreds of miles up the Yukon, for he knew that his word would be unquestioningly accepted. With the arrival of the first stampeders, Bonanza Creek woke up, and thereupon began a long-distance race between unveracity and truth, wherein, lie no matter how fast, men were continually overtaken and passed by truth. When men who doubted Carmack's report of 2.5 to the pan, themselves panned 2.5, they lied and said they were getting an ounce. And long ere their lie was fairly on its way, they were getting not 1 ounce, but 5 ounces. This, they claimed, was 10 ounces. But when they filled a pan of dirt to prove the lie, they washed out 12 ounces. And so it went. They continued valiantly to lie, but the truth continued to outrun them. One day in December, Daylight filled a pan from bedrock on his own claim and carried it into his cabin. Here a fire burned and enabled him to keep water unfrozen in a canvas tank. He squatted over the tank and began to wash. Earth and gravel seemed to fill the pan. As he imparted it to a circular movement, the lighter, coarser particles washed out over the edge. At times he combed the surface with his fingers, raking out handfuls of gravel. The contents of the pan diminished. As it drew near to the bottom for the purpose of fleeting and tentative examination, he gave the pan a sudden sloshing movement, emptying it of water. And the whole bottom showed as if covered with butter. Thus the yellow gold flashed up as the muddy water was flirted away. It was gold, gold dust, coarse gold, nuggets, large nuggets. He was all alone. He set the pan down for a moment and thought long thoughts. Then he finished the washing and weighed the results in his scales. At the rate of $16 to the ounce, the pan had contained 700 and odd dollars. It was beyond anything that he had ever dreamed. His fondest anticipations had gone no farther than $20,000 or $30,000 to a claim, but here were claims worth $500,000 each at the least, even if they were spotted. He did not go back to work in the shaft that day, nor the next, nor the next. Instead, capped and mittened, a light stampeding outfit, including his rabbit-skin robe strapped on his back, he was out and away on a many days' tramp over creeks and divides, inspecting the whole neighboring territory. On each creek he was entitled to locate one claim. But he was chary in thus surrendering up his chances. On Hunker Creek only did he stake a claim. Bonanza Creek he found staked from mouth to source, while every little draw and pup and gulch that drained into it was likewise staked. Little faith was had in these side streams. They had been staked by hundreds of men who had failed to get in on Bonanza. The most popular of these creeks was Adams. The one least fancied was El Dorado, which flowed into Bonanza just above Carmack's discovery claim. Even Daylight disliked the looks of El Dorado, but still, riding his hunch, he bought half a share in one claim on it for half a sack of flour. A month later, he paid $800 for the adjoining claim. 3 months later, enlarging his block of property, he paid $40,000 for a third claim, and though it was concealed in the future, he was destined, not long after, to pay $150,000 for a fourth claim on the creek that had been least liked of all the creeks. In the meantime, and from the day he washed $700 from a single pan and squatted over and thought a long thought, he never again touched hand to pick and shovel. As he said to Joe Ledoux the night of that wonderful washing, "Joe, I ain't never going to work hard again.
Here's where I begin to use my brains. I'm going to farm gold. Gold will grow if you all have the savvy and can get hold of some of the seed. When I seen them $700 in the bottom of the pan, I knew I had the seed at last.
Where are you going to plant it? Joe Ladue had asked.
And Daylight, with a wave of his hand, definitely indicated the whole landscape and the creeks that lay beyond the divides.
There she is, he said, and y'all just watch my smoke. There's millions here for the man who can see them. And I seen all them millions this afternoon when them $700 peeped up at me from the bottom of the pan and chirruped. Well, if here ain't Burning Daylight, come at last.
End of Part 1, Chapter 10.
Part 1, Chapter 11 of Burning Daylight by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The hero of the Yukon in the younger days before the Carmack strike, Burning Daylight now became the hero of the strike. The story of his hunch and how he rode it was told up and down the land. Certainly he had ridden it far and away beyond the boldest, for no five of the luckiest held the value in claims that he held. And furthermore, he was still riding the hunch, and with no diminution of daring. The wise ones shook their heads and prophesied that he would lose every ounce he had won. He was speculating, they contended, as if the whole country was made of gold, and no man could win who played a placer strike in that fashion. On the other hand, his holdings were reckoned as worth millions, and there were men so sanguine that they held the man a fool who coopered any bet Daylight laid. Behind his magnificent free-handedness and careless disregard for money were hard practical judgment, imagination, and vision, and the daring of the big gambler. He foresaw what with his own eyes he had never seen, and he played to win much or lose all. There's too much gold here in Bonanza to be just a pocket, he argued. It is sure come from a mother lode somewhere, and other creeks will show up. Y'all keep your eyes on Indian River. The creeks that drain that side of the Klondike watershed are just as likely to have gold as the creeks that drain this side. And he backed this opinion to the extent of grub-staking half a dozen parties of prospectors across the big divide into the Indian River region. Other men, themselves failing to stake on Lucky Creek, he put to work on his Bonanza claims, and he paid them well. $16 a day for an 8-hour shift, and he ran 3 shifts. He had grub to start them on, and when, on last the water, the Bella arrived loaded with provisions, he traded a warehouse site to Jack Kearns for a supply of grub that lasted all his men through the winter of 1896. And that winter, when famine pinched and flour sold for $2 a pound, he kept 3 shifts of men at work on all 4 of the Bonanza claims. Other mine owners paid $15 a day to their men, but he had been the first to put men to work, and from the first he paid them a full ounce a day. One result was that his were picked men, and they more than earned their higher pay. One of his wildest plays took place in early winter after the freeze-up. Hundreds of stampeders, after staking on other creeks than Bonanza, had gone on disgruntled downriver to 40 Mile and Circle City. Daylight mortgaged one of his Bonanza dumps with the Alaska Commercial Company and tucked a letter of credit into his pouch. Then he harnessed his dogs and went down on the ice at a pace that only he could travel. One Indian down, another Indian back, and 4 teams of dogs was his record. And at 40 Mile in Circle City, he bought claims by the score. Many of these were to prove utterly worthless, but some few of them were to show up more astoundingly than any on Bonanza. He bought right and left, paying as low as $50 and as high as $5,000. This highest one he bought in the Tivoli Saloon. It was an upper claim on El Dorado, and when he agreed to the price, Jacob Wilkins, an old-timer, just returned from a look at the moose pasture, got up and left the room, saying, "Daylight, I've known you 7 years, and you've always seemed sensible to now. And now you're just letting them rob you right and left. That's what it is, robbery. $5,000 for a claim on that damned moose pasture is bunco. I just can't stay in the room and see you buncoed that way." "I tell you all," Daylight answered, "Wilkins, Carmack strikes so big that we all can't see it all. It's a lottery. Every claim I buy is a ticket, and there's sure going to be some capital prizes." Jacob Wilkins, standing in the open door, sniffed incredulously. "Now supposing, Wilkins," Daylight went on, "supposing y'all knew it was going to rain soup. What'd y'all do? Buy spoons? Of course. Well, I'm sure buying spoons. She's going to rain soup up there on the Klondike, and them that has forks won't be catching none of it." But Wilkins here slammed the door behind him, and Daylight broke off to finish the purchase of the claim. Back in Dawson, though he remained true to his word and never touched hand to pick and shovel, he worked as hard as ever in his life. He had 1,000 irons in the fire, and they kept him busy. Representation work was expensive, and he was compelled to travel often over the various creeks in order to decide which claims should lapse and which should be retained. A quartz miner himself in his early youth, before coming to Alaska, he dreamed of finding the mother lode. A placer camp he knew was ephemeral, while a quartz camp abided, and he kept a score of men in the quest for months. The mother lode was never found, and years afterward he estimated that the search for it had cost him $50,000. But he was playing big. Heavy as were his expenses, he won more heavily. He took lays, bought half shares, shared with men he grub-staked, and made personal locations. Day and night his dogs were ready, and he owned the fastest teams, so that when a stampede to a new discovery was on, it was Burning Daylight to the fore through the longest, coldest nights, till he blazed his stakes next to discovery. In one way or another, to say nothing of the many worthless creeks, he came into possession of properties on the good creeks, such as Sulphur, Dominion, Excelsis, Seawash, Crystal, Alhambra, and Doolittle. The thousands he poured out flowed back in tens of thousands. 40-mile men told the story of his 2 tons of flour and made calculations of what it had returned him that ranged from 500,000 to 1,000,000. One thing was known beyond all doubt, namely, that the half share in the first El Dorado claim, bought by him for half a sack of flour, was worth $500,000. On the other hand, it was told that when Frida, the dancer, arrived from over the passes in a Peterborough canoe in the midst of the drive of mush ice on the Yukon, and when she offered $1,000 for 10 sacks and could find no sellers, he sent the flour to her as a present, without ever seeing her. In the same way, 10 sacks were sent to the lone Catholic priest who was starting the first hospital. His generosity was lavish. Others called it insane. At a time when, riding his hunch, he was getting 500,000 for 50,000 of flour, it was nothing less than insanity to give 20 whole sacks to a dancing girl and a priest. But it was his way. Money was only a marker. It was the game that counted with him. The possession of millions made little change in him, except that he played the game more passionately. Temperate as he had always been, save on rare occasions, now that he had the wherewithal for unlimited drink and had daily access to them, he drank even less. The most radical change lay in that, except when on the trail, he no longer did his own cooking. A broken-down miner lived in his log cabin with him and now cooked for him. But it was the same food: bacon, beans, flour, prunes, dried fruit, and rice. He still dressed as formerly: overalls, German socks, moccasins, flannel shirt, fur cap, and a blanket coat. He did not take up with cigars, which cost the cheapest from half a dollar to a dollar each. The same Bull Durham and brown paper cigarette, hand-rolled, contented him. It was true that he kept more dogs and paid enormous prices for them. They were not a luxury, but a matter of business. He needed speed in his traveling and stampeding, and by the same token, he hired a cook. He was too busy to cook for himself, that was all. It was poor business, playing for millions, to spend time building fires and boiling water. Dawson grew rapidly that winter of 1896. Money poured in on Daylight from the sale of town lots. He promptly invested it where it would gather more. In fact, he played the dangerous game of pyramiding, and no more perilous pyramiding than in a placer camp could be imagined. But he played with his eyes wide open. "You'll just wait till this news of the strike reaches the outside," he told his old-timer cronies in the Moosehorn Saloon. "The news won't get out till next spring. Then there's going to be three rushes: a summer rush of men coming in light, a fall rush of men with outfits, and a spring rush the next year after that of 50,000. Y'all won't be able to see the landscape for Chechakos. Well, there's a summer and fall rush of 1897 to commence with. What are y'all going to do about it?" "What are you going to do about it?" a friend demanded. "Nothing," he answered. "I sure already done it. I got a dozen gangs strung out up the Yukon getting out logs. Y'all see their rafts coming down after the river breaks. Cabins, they'll sure be worth what a man can pay for them next fall. Lumber, it will sure go top-notch. I've got two sawmills freighting in over the passes. They'll come down as soon as the lake opens up. And if y'all are thinking of needing lumber, I'll make y'all contracts right now. $300 a thousand, undressed." Corner lots in desirable locations were sold that winter for up to $10,000 to $30,000. Daylight sent word out over the trails and passes for the newcomers to bring down log rafts. And as a result, the summer of 1897 saw his sawmills working day and night on three shifts, and still he had logs left over with which to build cabins. These cabins, land included, sold from $1,000 to several thousand. Two-story log buildings in the business part of town brought him from $40,000 to $50,000 apiece. These fresh accretions of capital were immediately invested in other ventures. He turned gold over and over until everything that he touched seemed to turn to gold. But that first wild winter of Carmack's strike taught Daylight many things. Despite the prodigality of his nature, he had poise. He watched the lavish waste of the mushroom millionaires and failed quite to understand it. According to his nature and outlook, it was all very well to toss an ante away in a night's frolic. That was what he had done the night of the poker game in Circle City when he lost 50,000, all that he possessed. But he had looked on that 50,000 as a mere ante. When it came to millions, it was different. Such a fortune was at stake and was not to be sown on barroom floors, literally sown, flung broadcast out of the moose-hide sacks by drunken millionaires who had lost all sense of proportion. There was McMahon, who ran up a single barroom bill of $38,000, and Jimmy the Rough, who spent $100,000 a month for 4 months in riotous living, and then fell down drunk in the snow one March night and was frozen to death, and Swiftwater Bill, who, after spending three valuable claims in an extravagance of debauchery, borrowed $3,000 with which to leave the country, and who, out of this sum, because the lady love that jilted him liked eggs, cornered the 110 dozen eggs on the Dawson market, paying $24 a dozen for them, and promptly feeding them to the wolf dogs. Champagne sold at $40 to $50 a quart, and canned oyster stew at $15. Daylight indulged in no such luxuries. He did not mind treating a barroom of men to whiskey at 50 cents a drink, but there was somewhere in his own extravagant nature a sense of fitness and arithmetic that revolted against paying $15 for the contents of an oyster can. On the other hand, he possibly spent more money in relieving hard luck cases than did the wildest of the new millionaires on insane debauchery. Father Judge of the hospital could have told of far more important donations than that first 10 sacks of flour. Old-timers who came to Daylight invariably went away relieved according to their need. But $50 for a quart of fizzy champagne, that was appalling. And yet he still, on occasion, made one of his old-time hell-roaring nights. But he did so for different reasons. First, it was expected of him, because it had been his way in the old days, and second, he could afford it. But he no longer cared quite so much for that form of diversion. He had developed, in a new way, the taste for power. It had become a lust with him. By far the wealthiest miner in Alaska, he wanted to be still wealthier. It was a big game he was playing in, and he liked it better than any other game. In a way, the part he played was creative. He was doing something, and at no time, striking another chord of his nature, could he take the joy in a $1 million Eldorado dump that was at all equivalent to the joy he took in watching his two sawmills working and the big downriver log rafts swinging into the bank in the big eddy just above Moosehide Mountain. Gold, even on the scales, was, after all, an abstraction. It represented things and the power to do. But the sawmills were the things themselves, concrete and tangible, and they were things that were a means to the doing of more things. They were dreams come true, hard and indubitable realizations of fairy gossamers. With the summer rush from the outside came special correspondence for the big newspapers and magazines, and one and all, using unlimited space, they wrote Daylight up, so that, as far as the world was concerned, Daylight loomed the largest figure in Alaska. Of course, after several months, the world became interested in the Spanish War and forgot all about him. But in the Klondike itself, Daylight still remained the most prominent figure. Passing along the streets of Dawson, all heads turned to follow him, and in the saloons, chechakos watched him awesomely, scarcely taking their eyes from him as long as he remained in their range of vision. Not alone was he the richest man in the country, but he was Burning Daylight, the pioneer, the man who, almost in the midst of antiquity of that young land, had crossed the Chilkoot and drifted down the Yukon to meet those elder giants, Al Mayo and Jack McQuestion. He was the Burning Daylight of scores of wild adventures, the man who carried word to the ice-bound whaling fleet across the tundra wilderness to the Arctic Sea, who raced the mail from Circle to Saltwater and back again in 60 days, who saved the whole Tanana tribe from perishing in the winter of 91. In short, the man who smote the Chechakos' imaginations more violently than any other dozen men rolled into one. He had the fatal facility for self-advertisement. Things he did, no matter how adventurous or spontaneous, struck the popular imagination as remarkable. And the latest thing he had done was always on men's lips, whether it was being first in the heartbreaking stampede to Danish Creek, in killing the record bald-faced grizzly over on Sulphur Creek, or in winning the single paddle canoe race on the Queen's birthday, after being forced to participate at the last moment by the failure of the sourdough representative to appear. Then, one night in the Moosehorn, he locked horns with Jack Kearns in the long-promised return game of poker. The sky and 8 o'clock in the morning were made the limits, and at the close of the game, Daylight's winnings were $230,000. To Jack Kearns, already several times millionaire, this loss was not vital, but the whole community was thrilled by the size of the stakes, and each one of the dozen correspondents in the field sent out a sensational article. End of Part 1, Chapter 11. Part 1, Chapter 12 of Burning Daylight by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Despite his many sources of revenue, Daylight's pyramiding kept him pinched for cash throughout the first winter. The pay gravel, thawed on bedrock and hoisted to the surface, immediately froze again. Thus his dumps, containing several millions of gold, were inaccessible. Not until the returning sun thawed the dumps and melted the water to wash them was he able to handle the gold they contained. And then he found himself with a surplus of gold deposited in two of the newly organized banks, and he was promptly besieged by men and groups of men to enlist his capital in their enterprises. But he elected to play his own game, and he entered combinations only when they were generally defensive or offensive. Thus, though he had paid the highest wages, he joined the Mine Owners Association, engineered the fight, and effectually curbed the growing insubordination of the wage earners. Times had changed. The old days were gone forever. This was a new era, and Daylight, the wealthy mine owner, was loyal to his class affiliations. It was true the old-timers who worked for him, in order to be saved from the club of the organized owners, were made foremen over the gang of chechakos. But this, with Daylight, was a matter of heart, not head. In his heart, he could not forget the old days, while with his head, he played the economic game according to the latest and most practical methods. But outside of such group combinations of exploiters, he refused to bind himself to any man's game. He was playing a great lone hand, and he needed all his money for his own backing. The newly founded stock exchange interested him keenly. He had never before seen such an institution, but he was quick to see its virtues and to utilize it. Most of all, it was gambling, and on many an occasion, not necessary for the advancement of his own schemes, he, as he called it, went the stock exchange a flutter, out of sheer wantonness and fun. "It sure beats faro," was his comment one day, when, after keeping the Dawson speculators in a fever for a week, by alternate bullying and bearing, he showed his hand and cleaned up what would have been a fortune to any other man. Other men, having made their strike, had headed south for the States, taken a furlough from the grim Arctic battle. But asked when he was going outside, Daylight always laughed and said that when he had finished playing his hand. He added that a man was a fool to quit a game just when a winning hand had been dealt him. It was held by the thousands of hero-worshipping chechakos that Daylight was a man absolutely without fear. But Bettles and Dan MacDonald and other sourdoughs shook their heads and laughed as they mentioned women, and they were right. He had always been afraid of them from the time himself, a lad of 17, when Queen Anne of Juno made open and ridiculous love to him. For that matter, he never had known women. Born in a mining camp where they were rare and mysterious, having no sisters, his mother dying when he was an infant, he had never been in contact with them. True, running away from Queen Anne, He had later encountered them on the Yukon and cultivated an acquaintance with them, the pioneer ones who crossed the passes on the trail of the men who had opened up the first diggings. But no lamb had ever walked with a wolf in greater fear and trembling than he had walked with them. It was a matter of masculine pride that he should walk with them, and he had done so in fair seeming. But women had remained to him a closed book, and he preferred a game of solo or seven up any time. And now, known as the King of the Klondike, carrying several other royal titles, such as Eldorado King, Bonanza King, the Lumber Baron, and the Prince of the Stampeders, not to omit the proudest appellation of all, namely, the Father of the Sourdoughs, he was more afraid of women than ever. As never before, they held out their arms to him, and more women were flocking into the country day by day. It mattered not whether he sat at dinner in the gold commissioner's house, called for the drinks in a dance hall, or submitted to an interview from the woman representative of the New York Sun, one and all of them held out their arms. There was one exception, and that was Frida, the girl that danced, and to whom he had given the flower. She was the only woman in whose company he felt at ease, for she alone never reached out her arms, and yet it was from her that he was destined to receive next his severest fright. It came about in the fall of 1897. He was returning from one of his dashes, this time to inspect Henderson, a creek that entered the Yukon just below the Stewart. Winter had come on with a rush, and he fought his way down the Yukon 70 miles in a frail Peterborough canoe in the midst of a run of mush ice. Hugging the rim ice that had already solidly formed, he shot across the ice-spewing mouth of the Klondike just in time to see a lone man dancing excitedly on the rim and pointing into the water. Next, he saw the fur-clad body of a woman, face under, sinking in the midst of the driving mush ice. A lane opening in the swirl of the current, it was a matter of seconds to drive the canoe to the spot, reach to the shoulder in the water, and draw the woman gingerly to the canoe's side. It was Frida, and all might have yet been well with him, had she not later, when brought back to consciousness, blazed at him with angry blue eyes and demanded, "Why did you? Oh, why did you?" This worried him. In the nights that followed, instead of sinking immediately to sleep, as was his wont, he lay awake, visioning her face and that blue blaze of wrath, and conning her words over and over. They rang with sincerity. The reproach was genuine. She had meant just what she said, and still he pondered. The next time he encountered her, she had turned away from him angrily and contemptuously, and yet again she came to him to beg his pardon, and she dropped a hint of a man somewhere, sometime, she said not how, who had left her with no desire to live. Her speech was frank, but incoherent, and all he gleaned from it was that the event, whatever it was, had happened years before. Also he gleaned that she had loved the man. That was the thing, love. It caused a trouble. It was more terrible than frost or famine. Women were all very well in themselves, good to look upon and likable, but along came this thing called love, and they were seared to the bone by it, made so irrational that one could never guess what they would do next. This Frida woman was a splendid creature, full-bodied, beautiful, and nobody's fool. But love had come along and soured her on the world, driving her to the Klondike and to suicide so compelling that she was made to hate the man that saved her life. Well, he had escaped love so far, just as he had escaped smallpox. Yet there it was, contagious as smallpox, and a whole lot worse in running its course. It made men and women do such fearful and unreasonable things. It was like delirium tremens, only worse. and if he, Daylight, caught it, he might have it badly as any of them. It was lunacy, stark lunacy, and contagious on top of it all. A half a dozen young fellows were crazy over Frieda. They all wanted to marry her, yet she, in turn, was crazy over that some other fellow on the other side of the world, and would have nothing to do with them. But it was left to the Virgin to give him his final fright. She was found one morning dead in her cabin. A shot through the head had done it, and she had left no message, no explanation. Then came the talk. Some wit, voicing public opinion, called it a case of too much Daylight. She had killed herself because of him. Everybody knew this and said so. The correspondents wrote it up, and once more Burning Daylight, King of the Klondike, was sensationally featured in the Sunday supplements of the United States. The Virgin had straightened up, so the feature stories ran, and correctly so. Never had she entered a Dawson City dance hall. When she first arrived from Circle City, she had earned her living by washing clothes. Next, she had bought a sewing machine and made men's drill parkas, fur caps, and moosehide mittens. Then she had gone as a clerk into the First Yukon Bank. All this and more was known and told, though one and all were agreed that Daylight, while the cause, had been the innocent cause of her untimely end. And the worst of it was that Daylight knew it was true. Always he would remember that last night he had seen her. He had thought nothing of it at the time, but looking back, he was haunted by every little thing that had happened. In the light of the tragic event, he could understand everything. Her quietness, the calm certitude, as if all vexing questions of living had been smoothed out and were gone. And that certain ethereal sweetness about all that she had said and done that had been almost maternal. He remembered the way she had looked at him, how she had laughed when he narrated Mickey Dolan's mistake in staking the fraction on Skookum Gulch. Her laughter had been lightly joyous, while at the same time it had lacked the old-time robustness. Not that she had been grave or subdued. On the contrary, she had been so patently content, so filled with peace. She had fooled him, fool that he was. He had even thought that night that her feeling for him had passed, and he had taken delight in the thought, and caught visions of the satisfying future friendship that would be theirs with this perturbing love out of the way. And then, when he stood at the door, cap in hand, and said good night, it had struck him, at the time, as a funny and embarrassing thing, her bending over his hand and kissing it. He felt like a fool, but he shivered now when he looked back on it and felt again the touch of her lips on his hand. She was saying goodbye, an eternal goodbye, and he had never guessed. At that very moment, and for all the moments of the evening, coolly and deliberately, as he well knew her way, she had been resolved to die. If he had only known it. Untouched by the contagious malady himself, nevertheless, he would have married her if he had had the slightest inkling of what she contemplated. And yet he knew, furthermore, that hers was a certain stiff-kneed pride that would not have permitted her to accept marriage as an act of philanthropy. There had really been no saving her after all. The love disease had fastened upon her, and she had been doomed from the first to perish of it. Her one possible chance had been that he, too, should have caught it, and he had failed to catch it. Most likely, if he had, it would have been from Frieda or some other woman. There was Dartworthy, the college man, who had staked the rich fraction on Bonanza above Discovery. Everybody knew that old Doolittle's daughter, Bertha, was madly in love with him. Yet, when he contracted the disease, of all women, it had been with the wife of Colonel Wolfstone, the great Guggenhammer mining expert. Result, 3 lunacy cases. Dartworthy selling out his mine for 1/10 its value. The poor woman sacrificing her respectability and sheltered nook in society to flee with him in an open boat down the Yukon, and Colonel Wolfstone, breathing murder and destruction, taking out after them in another open boat. The whole impending tragedy had moved on down the muddy Yukon, passing 40 miles in circle and losing itself in the wilderness beyond. But there it was, love, disorganizing men's and women's lives, driving toward destruction and death, turning topsy-turvy everything that was sensible and considerate, making bawds or suicides out of virtuous women, and scoundrels and murderers out of men who had always been clean and square. For the first time in his life, Daylight lost his nerve. He was badly and avowedly frightened. Women were terrible creatures, and the love germ was especially plentiful in their neighborhood. And they were so reckless, so devoid of fear. They were not frightened by what had happened to the Virgin. They held out their arms to him more seductively than ever, even without his fortune, reckoned as a mere man, just past 30, magnificently strong and equally good-looking and good-natured, he was a prize for most normal women. But when to his natural excellences were added the romance that linked with his name and the enormous wealth that was his, practically every free woman he encountered measured him with an appraising and delighted eye, to say nothing of more than one woman who was not free. Other men might have been spoiled by this and led to lose their heads, but the only effect on him was to increase his fright. As a result, he refused most invitation to houses where women might be met, and frequented bachelor boards and the Moose Horn Saloon, which had no dance hall attached. End of Part 1, Chapter 12.
Part 1, Chapter 13 of Burning Daylight by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. 6,000 spent the winter of 1897 in Dawson, and work on the creeks went on apace, while beyond the passes it was reported that 100,000 more were waiting for the spring. Late one brief afternoon, Daylight, on the benches between French Hill and Skookum Hill, caught a wider vision of things. Beneath him lay the richest part of El Dorado Creek, while up and down Bonanza he could see for miles. It was a scene of a vast devastation. The hills to their tops had been shorn of trees. Their naked sides showed signs of goring and perforating that even the mantle of snow could not hide. Beneath him in every direction were the cabins of men, but not many men were visible. A blanket of smoke filled the valleys and turned the gray day to melancholy twilight. Smoke arose from a thousand holes in the snow, where, deep down on bedrock, in the frozen muck and gravel, the men crept and scratched and dug, and ever built more fires to break the grip of the frost. Here and there, where new shafts were starting, these fires flamed redly. Figures of men crawled out of the holes, or disappeared into them, or, on raised platforms of hand-hewn timber, windlassed the thawed gravel to the surface, where it immediately froze. The wreckage of the spring washings appeared everywhere. Piles of sluice boxes, sections of elevated flumes, huge water wheels, all the debris of an army of gold-mad men. "It's plain gophering," Daylight muttered aloud. He looked at the naked hills and realized the enormous wastage of wood that had taken place. From this bird's-eye view, he realized the monstrous confusion of their excited workings. It was a gigantic inadequacy. Each worked for himself, and the result was chaos. In this richest of diggings, it cost out by their feverish, unthinking methods, another dollar was left hopelessly in the earth. Given another year, and most of the claims would be worked out, the sum of the gold taken out would no more equal what was left behind.
Organization was what was needed, he decided, and his quick imagination sketched El Dorado Creek from mouth to source, and from mountaintop to mountaintop, in the hands of one capable management. Even stream thawing, as yet untried, but bound to come, he saw would be makeshift. What should be done was to hydraulic the valley sides and benches, and then, on the creek bottom, to use gold dredges, such as he had heard described as operating in California. There was the very chance of another big killing. He had wondered just what was precisely the reason for the Guggenhammers and the big English concerns sending in their high-salaried experts. That was their scheme. That was why they had approached him for the sale of worked-out claims and tailings. They were content to let the small mine owners gopher out what they could, for there would be millions in their leavings. And gazing down on the smoky inferno of crude effort, Daylight outlined the new game he would play, a game in which the Guggenhammers and the rest would have to reckon with him. Cut along with the delight in the new conception came a weariness. He was tired of the long Arctic years, and he was curious about the outside, the great world of which he had heard other men talk, and of which he was as ignorant as a child. There were games out there to play. It was a larger table, and there was no reason why he, with his millions, should not sit in and take a hand. So it was that afternoon on Skookum Hill that he resolved to play his last best Klondike hand and pull for the outside. It took time, however. He put trusted agents to work on the heels of great experts, and on the creeks where they began to buy, he likewise bought. Wherever they tried to corner a worked-out creek, they found him standing in the way, owning blocks of claims or artfully scattered claims that put all their plans to naught. "I play y'all wide open to win, am I right?" he told them once, in a heated conference. Followed wars, truces, compromises, victories, and defeats. By 1898, 60,000 men were on the Klondike, and all their fortunes and affairs rocked back and forth, and were affected by the battles Daylight fought. And more, the taste for the larger game urged in Daylight's mouth. Here he was already locked in grapples with the great Guggenhammers, and winning, fiercely winning. Possibly the severest struggle was waged on Ophir, the veriest of moose pastures, whose low-grade dirt was valuable only because of its vastness. The ownership of a block of seven claims in the heart of it gave Daylight his grip, and they could not come to terms. The Guggenhammer experts concluded that it was too big for him to handle, and when they gave him an ultimatum to that effect, he accepted and bought them out. The plan was his own, but he sent down to the States for competent engineers to carry it out. In the Rinkabilly watershed, 80 miles away, he built his reservoir, and for 80 miles the huge wooden conduit carried the water across country to the Ophir. Estimated at 3 millions, the reservoir and conduit cost nearly 4. Nor did he stop with this. Electric power plants were installed, and his workings were lighted, as well as run by electricity. Other sourdoughs who had struck it rich in excess of all their dreams shook their heads gloomily, warned him that he would go broke, and declined to invest in so extravagant a venture. But Daylight smiled and sold out the remainder of his townside holdings. He sold at the right time, at the height of the placer boom. When he prophesied to his old cronies in the Moosehorn Saloon that within 5 years town lots in Dawson could not be given away, while the cabins would be chopped up for firewood, he was laughed at roundly and assured that the mother lode would be found ere that time. But he went ahead, when his need for lumber was finished, selling out his sawmills as well. Likewise, he began to get rid of his scattered holdings on the various creeks, and without thanks to anyone, he finished his conduit, built his dredges, imported his machinery, and made the gold at Ophir immediately accessible. And he, who 5 years before had crossed over the divide from Indian River and threaded the silent wilderness, his dogs packing Indian fashion, himself living Indian fashion on straight moose meat, now heard the hoarse whistles calling his hundreds of laborers to work, and watched them toil under the white glare of the arc lamps. But having done this thing, he was ready to depart. And when he let the word go out, the Guggenhammers vied with the English concerns and with a new French company in bidding for the Ophir and all its plant. The Guggenhammers bid highest, and the price they paid netted Daylight a clean million. It was current rumor that he was worth anywhere from 20 to 30 millions. But he alone knew just how he stood, and that, with his last claim sold and the table swept clean of his winnings, he had ridden his hunch to the tune of just a trifle over 11 millions. His departure was a thing that passed into the history of the Yukon along with his other deeds. All the Yukon was his guest, Dawson the seat of the festivity. On that one last night, no man's dust save his own was good. Drinks were not to be purchased. Every saloon ran open, with extra relays of exhausted bartenders. And the drinks were given away. A man who refused this hospitality, and persisted in paying, found a dozen fights on his hands. The various chechikos rose up to defend the name of Daylight from such insult. And through it all, on moccasined feet, moved Daylight, hell-roaring, burning Daylight, overspilling with good nature and camaraderie, howling as he-wolf howl, and claiming the night as his, bending men's arms down to the bars, performing feats of strength, his bronzed face flushed with drink, his black eyes flashing, clad in overalls and blanket coat, his ear flaps dangling and his gauntleted mittens swinging from the cord across the shoulders. But this time it was neither an ante nor a stake that he threw away, but a mere marker in the game that he, who held so many markers, would not miss. As a night, it eclipsed anything that Dawson had ever seen. It was Daylight's desire to make it memorable, and his attempt was a success. A goodly portion of Dawson got drunk that night. The fall weather was on, and though the freeze up on the Yukon was still delayed, the thermometer was down to 25 below zero and falling. Wherefore, it was necessary to organize gangs of lifesavers, who patrolled the streets to pick up drunken men from where they fell in the snow, and where an hour's sleep would be fatal. Daylight, whose whim it was to make them drunk by hundreds and by thousands, was the one who initiated this life-saving. He wanted Dawson to have its night, but in his deeper processes, never careless nor wanton, he saw to it that it was a night without accident. And like his olden nights, his ukase went forth that there should be no quarreling, no fighting, offenders to be dealt with by him personally. Nor did he have to deal with any. Hundreds of devoted followers saw to it that the evilly disposed were rolled in the snow and hustled off to bed. In the great world, where great captains of industry die, all wheels, under their erstwhile management, are stopped for a minute. But in the Klondike, such was its hilarious sorrow at the departure of its captain, that for 24 hours no wheels revolved. Even great Ophir, with its 1,000 men on the payroll, closed down. On the day after the night, there were no men present or fit to go to work. Next morning, at break of day, Dawson said goodbye. The thousands that lined the bank wore mittens, and their ear flaps pulled down and tied. It was 30 below zero, the rim ice was thickening, and the Yukon carried a run of mush ice. From the deck of the Seattle, Daylight waved and called his farewells. As the lines were cast off and the steamer swung out into the current, those near him saw the moisture well up in Daylight's eyes. In a way, it was to him departure from his native land, this grim Arctic region which was practically the only land he had known. He tore off his cap and waved it. "Goodbye, y'all," he called. "Goodbye, y'all." End of part 1, chapter 13.
Part 2, Chapter 1 of Burning Daylight by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. In no blaze of glory did Burning Daylight descend upon San Francisco. Not only had he been forgotten, but the Klondike along with him. The world was interested in other things, and the Alaskan adventure, like the Spanish War, was an old story. Many things had happened since then. Exciting things were happening every day, and the sensation space of newspapers was limited. The effect of being ignored, however, was an exhilaration. Big man as he had been in the Arctic game, it merely showed how much bigger was this new game. When a man, worth 11 millions, and with a history such as his, passed unnoticed. He settled down in the St. Francis Hotel, was interviewed by cub reporters on the hotel run, and received brief paragraphs of notice for 24 hours. He grinned to himself and began to look around and get acquainted with the new order of beings and things. He was very awkward and very self-possessed. In addition to the stiffening afforded his backbone by the conscious ownership of 11 millions, he possessed an enormous certitude. Nothing abashed him, nor was he appalled by the display and culture and power around him. It was another kind of wilderness, that was all, and it was for him to learn the ways of it, the signs and trails and waterholes, where good hunting lay, and the bad stretches of field and flood to be avoided. As usual, he fought shy of the women. He was still too badly scared to come close quarters with the dazzling and resplendent creatures his own millions made accessible. They looked and longed, but he so concealed his timidity that he had all the seeming of moving boldly among them. Nor was it his wealth alone that attracted them. He was too much a man, and too much an unusual type of man. Young yet, barely 36, eminently handsome, magnificently strong, almost bursting with a splendid virility, his free trail stride, never learned on pavements, and his black eyes, hinting of great spaces and unwearied with the close perspective of the city dwellers, drew many a curious and wayward feminine glance. He saw, grinned knowingly to himself, and faced them as so many dangers, with a cool demeanor that was a far greater personal achievement than had they been famine, frost, or flood. He had come down to the States to play the man's game, not the woman's game, and the men he had not yet learned. They struck him as soft, soft physically, yet he divined them hard in their dealings, but hard under an exterior of supple softness. It struck him that there was something cat-like about them. He met them in the clubs and wondered how real was the good fellowship they displayed and how quickly they would unsheath their claws and gouge and rend. "That's the proposition," he repeated to himself. "What will they do when the play is close and down to brass tacks?" He felt unwarrantably suspicious of them. "They're sure slick," was his secret judgment. And from bits of gossip dropped now and again, he felt his judgment well buttressed. On the other hand, they radiated an atmosphere of manliness, and the fair play that goes with manliness. They might gouge and rend in a fight, which was no more than natural, but he felt, somehow, that they would gouge and rend according to rule. This was the impression he got of them, a generalization tempered by knowledge
that there was bound to be a certain percentage of scoundrels among them. Several months passed in San Francisco, during which time he studied the game and its rules, and prepared himself to take a hand. He even took private instruction in English, and succeeded in eliminating his worst faults, though in moments of excitement he was prone to lapse into y'all, knowed, sure, and similar solecisms. He learned to eat and dress and generally comport himself after the manner of civilized man. But through it all he remained himself, not unduly reverential nor considerative, and never hesitating to stride roughshod over any soft-faced convention if it got in his way, and the provocation was great enough. Also, and unlike the average run of weaker men coming from back countries and far places, he failed to reverence the particular tin gods worshipped variously by the civilized tribes of men. He had seen totems before, and he knew them for what they were. Tired of being merely an onlooker, he ran up to Nevada, where the new gold-mining boom was fairly started, just to try a flutter, as he phrased it to himself. The flutter on the Tonopah Stock Exchange lasted just 10 days, during which time his smashing, wild bull game played ducks and drakes with the more stereotyped gamblers, and at the end of which time, having gambled Floridale into his fist, he let go for a net profit of $500,000. Whereupon, smacking his lips, he departed for San Francisco and the St. Francis Hotel. It tasted good, and his hunger for the game became more acute. And once more the papers sensationalized him. Burning Daylight was a big-letter headline again. Interviewers flocked about him. Old files of magazines and newspapers were searched through, and the romantic and historic Elim Harnish, adventurer of the frost, king of the Klondike, and father of the sourdoughs, strode upon the breakfast table of a million homes, along with the toast and breakfast foods. Even before his elected time, he was forcibly launched into the game. Financiers and promoters and all the flotsam and jetsam of the sea of speculation surged upon the shores of his 11 millions. In self-defense, he was compelled to open offices. He had made them sit up and take notice, and now, willy-nilly, they were dealing him hands and clamoring for him to play. Well, play he would. He'd show 'em, even despite the elated prophecies made of how swiftly he would be trimmed, prophecies coupled with the descriptions of the bucolic game he would play and of his wild and woolly appearance. He dabbled in little things at first, stalling for time, as he explained it, to Holdsworthy, a friend he had made at the Alta Pacific Club. Daylight himself was a member of the club, and Holdsworthy had proposed him. And it was well that Daylight played closely at first, for he was astounded by the multitudes of sharks, ground sharks he called them, that flocked about him. He saw through their schemes readily enough, and even marveled that such numbers of them could find sufficient prey to keep them going. Their rascality and general dubiousness was so transparent that he could not understand how anyone could be taken in by them. And then he found that there were sharks and sharks. Holdsworthy treated him more like a brother than a mere fellow clubman, watching over him, advising him, and introducing him to the magnates of the local financial world. Holdsworth family lived in a delightful bungalow near Menlo Park, and here Daylight spent a number of weekends, seeing a fineness and kindness of home life of which he had never dreamed. Holdsworthy was an enthusiast over flowers, and a half-lunatic over raising prize poultry, and these engrossing madnesses were a source of perpetual joy to Daylight, who looked on in tolerant good humor. Such amiable weaknesses tokened the healthfulness of the man, and Daylight drew closer to him. A prosperous, successful businessman, without great ambitions, was Daylight's estimate of him, a man too easily satisfied with the small stakes of the game ever to launch out in a big play. On one such weekend visit, Holdsworthy let him in on a good thing, a good little thing, a brickyard at Glen Ellen. Daylight listened closely to the other's description of the situation. It was a most reasonable venture, and Daylight's one objection was that it was so small a matter and so far out of his line, and he went into it only as a matter of friendship. Holdsworthy explaining that he was himself already in a bit, and that while it was a good thing, he would be compelled to make sacrifices in other directions in order to develop it. Daylight advanced the capital, $50,000, and as he laughingly explained it afterward, "I was stung all right, but it wasn't Holdsworthy that did it, half as much as those blamed chickens and fruit trees of his." It was a good lesson, however, for he learned that there were few faiths in the business world, and that even the simple, homely faith of breaking bread and eating salt counted for little in the face of a worthless brickyard and $50,000 in cash. But the sharks and sharks of various orders and degrees, he concluded, were on the surface. Deep down, he divined, were the integrities and the stabilities. These big captains of industry and masters of finance, he decided, were the men to work with. By the very nature of their huge deals and enterprises, they had to play fair. No room there for little sharpers' tricks and bunco games. It was to be expected that little men should salt gold mines with a shotgun and work off worthless brickyards on their friends, but in high finance such methods were not worthwhile. There the men were engaged in developing the country, organizing its railroads, opening up its mines, making accessible its vast natural resources. Their play was bound to be big and stable. "They sure can't afford tin-horn tactics," was his summing up. So it was that he resolved to leave the little men, the Holdsworthies, alone, and, while he met them in good fellowship, he chummed with none and formed no deep friendships. He did not dislike the little men. The men of the Alta Pacific, for instance, he merely did not elect to choose them for partners in the big game in which he intended to play. What the big game was, he did not know. He was waiting to find it, and in the meantime, he played small hands, investing in several arid lands reclamation projects, and keeping his eyes open for the big chance when it should come along. And then he met John Dowsett, the great John Dowsett. The whole thing was fortuitous. This cannot be doubted, as Daylight himself knew. It was by the merest chance, when in Los Angeles, that he heard the tuna were running strong at Santa Catalina, and went over to the island instead of returning directly to San Francisco as he had planned. There he met John Dowsett, resting off for several days in the middle of a flying western trip. Dowsett had, of course, heard of the spectacular Klondike King and his rumored 30 millions, and he certainly found himself interested by the man in the acquaintance that was formed. Somewhere along in this acquaintanceship, the idea must have popped into his brain, but he did not broach it, preferring to mature it carefully. So he talked in large general ways and did his best to be agreeable and win Daylight's friendship. It was the first big magnate Daylight had met face to face, and he was pleased and charmed. There was such a kindly humanness about the man, such a genial democraticness, that Daylight found it hard to realize that this was the John Dowsett, president of a string of banks, insurance manipulator, reputed ally of lieutenants of Standard Oil, and known ally of the Guggenhammers. Nor did his looks belie his reputation and his manner. Physically, he guaranteed all that Daylight knew of him. Despite his 60 years and snow-white hair, his handshake was firmly hearty, and he showed no signs of decrepitude, walking with a quick, snappy step, making all movements definitely and decisively. His skin was a healthy pink, and his thin, clean lips knew the way to writhe heartily over a joke. He had honest blue eyes of palest blue. They looked out at one keenly and frankly from under shaggy gray brows. His mind showed itself disciplined and orderly, and its working struck Daylight as having all the certitude of a steel trap. He was a man who knew, and who never decorated his knowledge with foolish frills or sentiment or emotion. That he was accustomed to command was patent, and every word and gesture tingled with power. Combined with this was his sympathy and tact, and Daylight could note easily enough all the earmarks that distinguished him from a little man of the Holdsworthy caliber. Daylight knew also his history, the prime old American stock from which he had descended. His own war record, the John Dowsett before him, who had been one of the banking buttresses of the cause of the Union, the Commodore Dowsett of the War of 1812, the General Dowsett of Revolutionary fame, and that first Farr Dowsett, owner of lands and slaves in early New England. "He is sure the real thing," he told one of his fellow clubmen afterwards in the smoking room of the Alta Pacific. "I'll tell you, Gallen, he was a genuine surprise to me. I knew the big ones had to be like that, but I had to see him to really know it. He's one of the fellows that does things. You can see it sticking out all over him. He's one in a thousand. That's straight. A man to tie to. There's no limit to any game he plays, and you can stack on it that he plays right up to the handle. I bet he could lose or win half a dozen million without batting an eye." Gallen puffed at a cigar, and at the conclusion of the panegyric regarded the other curiously. But Daylight, ordering cocktails, failed to note this curious stare. "Going in with him on some deal, I suppose," Gallen remarked. "Nope, not the slightest idea. Here's kindness. I was just explaining that I'd come to understand how these big fellows do big things. Why, do you know, he gave me such a feeling that he knew everything, that I was plumb ashamed of myself. I guess I could give him cards and spades. When it comes to driving a dog team, though," Daylight observed, after a meditative pause, "and I really believe I could put him on to a few wrinkles in poker and placer mining, and maybe in paddling a birch canoe. And maybe I stand a better chance to learn the game he's been playing all his life than he would stand of learning the game I played up north." End of part 2, chapter 1.
Part 2, Chapter 2 of Burning Daylight by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. It was not long afterward that Daylight came to New York. A letter from John Dowsett had been the cause, a simple little typewritten letter of several lines. But Daylight had thrilled as he read it. He remembered the thrill that was his, a callow youth of 15, when, in Tempest Butte, through lack of a fourth man, Tom Galsworthy, gambler, had said, "Get in, kid, take a hand." That thrill was his now. The bald typewritten sentences seemed gorged with mystery. "Our Mr. Howison will call upon you at your hotel. He is to be trusted. We must not be seen together. You will understand after we have had our talk." Daylight conned the words over and over. That was it. The big game had arrived, and it looked as if he were being invited to sit in and take a hand. Surely, for no other reason, would one man so peremptorily invite another man to make a journey across the continent. They met, thanks to our Mr. Howison, up the Hudson, in a magnificent country home. Daylight, according to instructions, arrived in a private motor car which had been furnished him. Whose car it was he did not know, any more than he did know the owner of the house,
with its generous, rolling, tree-studded lawns. Dowsett was already there, and another man whom Daylight recognized before the introduction was begun. It was Nathaniel Letton, and none other. Daylight had seen his face a score of times in the magazines and newspapers, and read about his standing in the financial world and about his endowed University of Daratona. He, likewise, struck Daylight as a man of power, though he was puzzled in that he could find no likeness to Dowsett, except in the matter of cleanliness, a cleanliness that seemed to go down to the deepest fibers of him. Nathaniel Letton was unlike the other in every particular. Thin to emaciation, he seemed the cold flame of a man of mysterious, chemic sort of flame, who, under a glacier-like exterior, conveyed, somehow, the impression of the ardent heat of a thousand suns. His large gray eyes were mainly responsible for this feeling, and they blazed out feverishly from what was almost a death's head, so thin was the face, the skin of which was a ghastly, dull, dead white. Not more than 50, thatched with a sparse growth of iron-gray hair, he looked several times the age of Dowsett. Yet Nathaniel Letton possessed control. Daylight could see that plainly. He was a thin-faced ascetic, living in a state of high, attenuated calm, a molten planet under a transcontinental ice sheet. And yet, above all, most of all, Daylight was impressed by the terrific and almost awful cleanliness of the man. There was no dross in him. He had all the seeming of having been purged by fire. Daylight had the feeling that a healthy man oath would be a deadly offense to his ears, a sacrilege and a blasphemy. They drank. That is, Nathaniel Letton took mineral water, served by the smoothly operating machine of a lackey who inhabited the place, while Dowsett took scotch and soda, and Daylight a cocktail. Nobody seemed to notice the unusualness of a martini at midnight, though Daylight looked sharply for that very thing, for he had long since learned that martinis had their strictly appointed times and places. But he liked martinis, and being a natural man, he chose deliberately to drink when and how he pleased. Others had noticed this peculiar habit of his, but not so Dowsett and Letton, and Daylight's secret thought was, they sure wouldn't bat an eye if I called for a glass of corrosive sublimate. Leon Guggenhammer arrived in the midst of the drink and ordered scotch. Daylight studied him curiously. This was one of the great Guggenhammer family, a younger one, but nevertheless one of the crowd with which he had locked grapples in the north. Nor did Leon Guggenhammer fail to mention cognizance of that old affair. He complimented Daylight on his prowess. The echoes of Ophir came down to us, you know, and I must say, Mr. Daylight, Mr. Harnish, that you whipped us roundly in that affair. Echoes? Daylight could not escape the shock of the phrase. Echoes had come down to them of the fight into which he had flung all his strength and the strength of his Klondike millions. The Guggenhammer sure must go some, when a fight of that dimension was no more than a skirmish, of which they deigned to hear echoes. They sure play an almighty big game down here, was his conclusion, accompanied by a corresponding elation that it was just precisely that almighty big game in which he was about to be invited to play a hand. For the moment, he poignantly regretted that the rumor was not true, and that his 11 millions were not in reality 30 millions. Well, that much he would be frank about. He would let them know exactly how many stacks of chips he could buy. Leon Guggenhammer was young and fat. Not a day more than 30, his face, save for the adumbrated puff sacks under the eyes, was as smooth and lineless as a boy's. He, too, gave the impression of cleanliness. He showed in the pink of health. His unblemished, smooth-shaven skin shouted advertisement of his splendid physical condition. In the face of that perfect skin, his very fatness and mature, rotund paunch could be nothing other than normal. He was constituted to be prone to fatness. That was all. The talk soon centered down to business, though Guggenhammer had first to say his say about the forthcoming international yacht race and about his own palatial steam yacht, the Electra, whose recent engines were already antiquated. Dowsett broached the plan, added by an occasional remark from the other two, while Daylight asked questions. Whatever the proposition was, he was going into it with his eyes open, and they filled his eyes with a practical vision of what they had in mind. "They will never dream you are with us," Guggenhammer interjected, as the outline of the matter drew to a close. His handsome Jewish eyes flashing enthusiastically. "They'll think you are raiding on your own in proper buccaneer style." "Of course you understand, Mr. Harnish, the absolute need for keeping our alliance in the dark," Nathaniel Letton warned gravely. Daylight nodded his head. "And you also understand," Letton went on, "that the result can only be productive of good. The thing is legitimate and right, and the only ones who may be hurt are the stock gamblers themselves. It is not an attempt to smash the market. As you see for yourself, you are to bull the market. The honest investor will be the gainer." "Yes, that's the very thing," Dowsett said. "The commercial need for copper is continually increasing. Ward Valley Copper, and all that it stands for, practically one-quarter of the world's supply, as I have shown you, is a big thing. How big, even we can scarcely estimate. Our arrangements are made. We have plenty of capital ourselves, and yet we want more. Also, there is too much Ward Valley out to suit our present plans. Thus we kill both birds with one stone." "And I am the stone?" Daylight broke in with a smile. "Yes, just that. Not only will you bull Ward Valley, but you will at the same time gather Ward Valley in. This will be of inestimable advantage to us, while you and all of us will profit by it as well. And as Mr. Letton has pointed out, the thing is legitimate and square. On the 18th, the directors meet, and instead of the customary dividend, a double dividend will be declared." "And where will the shorts be then?" Leon Guggenhammer cried excitedly. "The shorts will be the speculators," Nathaniel Letton explained. "The gamblers, the froth of Wall Street, you understand. The genuine investors will not be hurt. Furthermore, they will have learned, for the thousandth time, to have confidence in Ward Valley. And with their confidence, we can carry through the large developments we have outlined to you." "There will be all sorts of rumors on the street," Dowsett warned Daylight, "but do not let them frighten you. These rumors may even originate with us. You can see how and why clearly. But the rumors are to be no concern of yours. You are on the inside, and all you have to do is buy, 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 and keep on buying to the last stroke, when the directors declare the double dividend. Ward Valley will jump so that it won't be feasible to buy after that." "What we want," Letton took up the strain, pausing significantly to sip his mineral water, "what we want is to take large blocks of Ward Valley off the hands of the public. We could do this easily enough by depressing the market and frightening the holders. And we could do it more cheaply in such a fashion. But we are absolute masters of the situation, and we are fair enough to buy Ward Valley on a rising market. Not that we are philanthropists, but that we need the investors in our big development scheme. Nor do we lose directly by the transaction. The instant the action of the directors becomes known, Ward Valley will rush heavenward. In addition, and outside the legitimate field of the transaction, we will pinch the shorts for a very large sum. But that is only incidental, you understand, and in a way unavoidable. On the other hand, we shall not turn up our noses at that phase of it. The shorts shall be the veriest gamblers, of course, and they will get no more than they deserve." "And one other thing, Mr. Harnish," Guggenhammer said. "If you exceed your available cash or the amount you care to invest in the venture, don't fail immediately to call on us. Remember, we are behind you." "Yes, we are behind you," Dowsett repeated. Nathaniel Letton nodded his head in affirmation. "Now about that double dividend on the 18th, John Dowsett drew a slip of paper from his notebook and adjusted his glasses. "Let me show you the figures. Here, you see." And thereupon he entered into a long technical and historic explanation of the earnings and dividends of Ward Valley from the day of its organization. The whole conference lasted no more than an hour, during which time Daylight lived at the topmost of the highest peak of life that he had ever scaled. These men were big players. They were powers. True, as he knew himself, they were not the real inner circle. They did not rank with the Morgans and Harrimans, and yet they were in touch with those giants and were themselves lesser giants. He was pleased, too, with their attitude toward him. They met him deferentially, but not patronizingly. It was the deference of equality, and Daylight could not escape the subtle flattery of it, for he was fully aware that in experience as well as wealth, they were far and away beyond him. "We shall shake up the speculating crowd," Leon Guggenhammer proclaimed jubilantly as they rose to go. "And you are the man to do it, Mr. Harnish. They are bound to think you are on your own, and their shears are all sharpened for the trimming of newcomers like you." "They will certainly be misled," Letton agreed, his eerie gray eyes blazing out from the voluminous folds of the huge Mueller with which he was swathing his neck to the ears. "Their minds run in ruts. It is the unexpected that upsets their stereotyped calculations. Any new combination, any strange factor, any fresh variant. And you will be all that to them, Mr. Harnish. And I repeat, they are gamblers, and they will deserve all that befalls them. They clog and cumber all legitimate enterprise. You have no idea of the trouble they cause men like us. Sometimes by their gambling tactics, upsetting the soundest plans, even overturning the stablest institutions." Dowsett and young Guggenhammer went away in one motor car, and Letton by himself in another. Daylight, with still in the forefront of his consciousness all that had occurred in the preceding hour, was deeply impressed by the scene at the moment of departure. The three machines stood like weird night monsters at the graveled foot of the wide stairway under the unlighted porte cochere. It was a dark night, and the lights of the motor cars cut as sharply through the blackness as knives would cut through solid substance. The obsequious lackey, the automatic genie of the house, which belonged to none of the three men, stood like a graven statue after having helped them in. The fur-coated chauffeurs bulked dimly in their seats. One after the other, like spurred steeds, the cars leaped into the blackness, took the curve of the driveway, and were gone. Daylight's car was the last, and peering out, he caught a glimpse of the unlighted house that loomed hugely through the darkness like a mountain. Whose was it, he wondered? How came they to use it for their secret conference? Would the lackey talk? How about the chauffeurs? Were they trusted men like our Mr. Howison? Mystery. The affair was alive with it, and hand in hand, with mystery walked power. He leaned back and inhaled his cigarette. Big things were afoot. The cards were shuffled, even for a mighty deal, and he was in on it. He remembered back to his poker games with Jack Kearns and laughed aloud. He had played for thousands in those days on the turn of a card. Now he was playing for millions. And on the 18th, when that dividend was declared, he chuckled at the confusion that would inevitably descend upon the men with the sharpened shears waiting to trim him. Him, Burning Daylight. End of Part 2, Chapter 2.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.